Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest superstorm and speak with Michael Mann, the Nobel Prize-winning founder and contributor to the award-winning science website realclimate.org. We will discuss this latest extreme weather event in the context of the global warming challenge that President Obama will likely address in Tuesday's State of the Union, while Senator Marco Rubio, who will offer the Republican rebuttal, may explain why he does not believe that global warming is real. Then we'll look into how many challenges face the president and whether he can address them all in his State of the Union and hope to achieve some legislative victory in his second term, with a hostile and implacable House determined to impose austerity that will tank the economy and doom any hopes of recovery. Democratic strategist Ed Kilgore, the principal writer of the Washington Monthly's Political Animal blog, joins us to discuss whether the president has spread himself too thin and what advice the Democrats will take from Bill Clinton's recent pep talk. Then finally, we will speak with author and award-winning investigative journalist Joe Dominic, who is a leading authority on the Los Angeles Police Department. He has written To Protect and Serve, the LAPD Century of War in the City of Dreams, and is writing Road to Reckoning, the Collapse and Reformation of the LAPD. With the LAPD now under siege from a former member of its ranks who is on a vengeful murder spree vowing to kill senior LAPD officers and their families, we will discuss efforts by the fugitive to frame his grudge and blame his dismissal on racial injustice. And joining us now is Michael Mann, the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. He's a co-founder and contributor to the award-winning science website realclimate.org. And in 2007, he shared the Nobel Peace Prize with others on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. His books include Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming, and The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Mann.
Thanks. It's great to be back with you.
And you've described this latest weather events in the northeast in New England, where in Connecticut, for example, they really got hammered. And you described this as the weather on steroids.
That's right. I mean, obviously, you know, nor'easters like this latest storm, Nemo, are going to happen naturally. We're always going to have weather, and we're going to have extreme weather. But that weather is taking place within a new context, within a globe that is warmer, with oceans that are warmer and put more moisture into the atmosphere, and that's part of the energy that helps intensify storms of this sort. So when you look at what's happening collectively with more extreme nor'easter-type storms, more intense hurricanes, more intense flooding events, that can be attributed collectively to the effect that we are having through human-caused climate change on our weather, an effect that's leading to more extreme weather events like Nemo.
Well, apparently, specifically in the case of Nemo, my understanding is that in a curious way, it's been too cold to snow heavily. But when you bring in the warmer air from the Gulf of Mexico, you set up this big storm.
That's right. You know, we have the storm that occurred more than a decade ago, sometimes referred to as the perfect storm. This storm, in a sense, was perhaps an even more perfect storm, in that it occurred with near record ocean surface temperatures off the east coast of New England. So the North Atlantic is quite warm right now, especially in the region neighboring New England. And that storm, it's a classic nor'easter. It formed, it was a low-pressure system that formed off the coast. And the winds were picking up all of that moisture from that very warm ocean surface and bringing them around the other side of storm inland to where it was quite cold. And so we had a very warm source of moisture, a large amount of moisture that was then circulated by the storm into New England, where it fell as record snowfall. And there is a relationship. There's a very fundamental physical relationship between how warm the ocean surface is and how much moisture, it can evaporate into the atmosphere, moisture that's available for forming snowfalls. So what happened there was tied to the unusually warm ocean conditions, and we know that there's a human component in that warming of the ocean.
Well, apparently, though, the ocean itself has risen. In Boston, for example, it's risen a foot in the last 90 years.
Absolutely, and that compounds the problem. That was a factor in the record flooding that we saw with Hurricane Sandy in New York City this fall, and it was a factor in the coastal surge that we saw associated with this storm, where there was quite a bit of flooding along parts of eastern Massachusetts, the parts of the coastline of eastern Massachusetts. Every single one of those storms now sits on an ocean that's more than a foot higher than it was a century ago because of global warming. And that means that every single one of these coastal flooding events, it too has a component which is related to human-caused climate change. So even if one disputed all of the other factors that I talked about that helped create a context where a storm like this, where conditions were more favorable for a storm like this, just the rising sea levels from human-caused global warming have already worsened the impacts of storms like Nemo and like Sandy.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Mann, who's the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. He's a co-founder and contributor to the award-winning science website, realclimate.org. And in 2007, he shared the Nobel Peace Prize with others on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. His books include Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming, and The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. And the hockey stick analogy is, I take it, Michael, is that the climate throughout the centuries has been, you know, the long part of the hockey stick. It's just been level, and then suddenly it's just, all of a sudden, it's abruptly turned upwards and curved like the end of a hockey stick. Is that describing it?
Yeah. So that's the term that was applied to this reconstruction that of past temperatures that my co-authors and I published more than a decade ago. It shows a long-term cooling trend prior to industrialization, and then a very rapid warming over the past century and a half that's unprecedented, as far back as we were able to take our estimates, 1,000 years back in time. And so this graph became an icon in the climate change debate, and because of that, it became an object of attack for those looking to discredit the science of climate change. And I found myself in the crosshairs of those attacks. And so my book, The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, describes my experiences as a scientist, as a scientist who reluctantly and accidentally became a public figure because of the way that this graph that we had produced figured into the larger debate over climate change. But, you know, that blade of the hockey stick that you refer to, in fact, is a good analogy for what's happening with a number of aspects of our climate. It's not just that global temperatures are increasing in an anomalous way. We've seen a record rate of decline in the amount of sea ice in the Arctic, and that has profound implications for our climate. We actually have seen a very large increase in the intensity of winter precipitation events in New England. In fact, NOAA put out a graph earlier this week that shows that, in fact, Nemo, this record 24-hour snowfall in many regions of New England from Nemo, is actually part of a longer-term trend where we've seen far more intense winter snowfall events of this sort, and it is part of the larger changes that are taking place in our climate, many of which are quite detrimental because of the greenhouse gases that we are putting into the atmosphere from fossil fuel burning and other activities.
So, Michael Mann, do you expect the president to talk about climate change on Tuesday in the State of the Union?
I certainly hope he does. I think that, he pleased many of my colleagues and me by making climate change a featured topic in his inauguration speech some weeks ago. He has given a number of indications in in the lead up to his second term, that he does plan to make climate change a much higher priority in his second term than he did in his first term. Now, as they often say, the devil is in the details, and I think many of us who feel quite strongly that this is an issue that we can't wait to address, that there's an urgency now to averting potentially catastrophic climate change that demands that we act now. And we will be very interested to see what sorts of specific concrete actions he's proposing to take in his second term. And hopefully he'll lay that out in a little bit more detail in his State of the Union speech. Ironically, and it's part of what all too unfortunate pattern that's emerged, the partisan divide that's emerged in the climate change debate. My understanding is that Marco Rubio of Florida will be giving the response to the State of the Union address, and he has recently expressed what you might describe as contrarianism or even denial of the threat of climate change, and there's the potential that he may, in fact, present the opposite view in the response. And that would be very unfortunate, because we need to have a good faith debate about what policies to enact to deal with this threat. But we can no longer continue to have this unworthy debate about whether the problem even exists. And unfortunately, there are many in our politics who want to just bury their heads in the sands and pretend the problem doesn't even exist.
Well, Marco Rubio just recently said it doesn't exist, or at least it's not man-made.
Right.
So he is the sort of pin-up boy of denial and the problem that entails, because obviously, as you point out, Michael Mann, you can't deal with the problem when you deny the fact that a problem exists, although the evidence is manifest. Now,
I was just going to add that I actually tweeted earlier today a link to an article that talks about Marco Rubio's stance on climate change. So for people who want to check that out, my Twitter handle is Michael E. Mann.
Well, but the president himself, it seems to me that he ought to come up with a different approach. I mean, in his first State of the Union, in his past addresses, he talked about green jobs. That's gone nowhere, and that never caught on. I mean, it seems to me that following Sandy and following Nimoy, this is the time is right now for him to make a stand about the overwhelming evidence that nature is providing us now. And
yeah,
also
absolutely.
point out that this is going to get worse. I mean, this is just the beginning of a cycle, is it? I mean, this is the new normal, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's the new normal, and there will be no analogy for what we're headed towards. In other words, we're seeing in many regions heat during the spring that we used to see during the summer over a large part of the country. And if we continue on the trajectory we're on, we are going to see summer heat in the future over many parts of the U.S. and associated drought impacts that are unlike anything we've ever seen. It's interesting that the point that you just made was one that was driven home in an editorial by the Washington Post just today, where they, in fact, have said that it isn't enough for the president to just frame this issue in generic terms having to do with green jobs and energy security, because that neglects the fact that the real reason to shift away from our reliance on fossil fuels is the damage that those carbon emissions are having on the planet through climate change. And if you neglect that impact, then there just isn't the proper incentive structure in place to incentivize the shift away from fossil fuels towards other sources of energy that aren't degrading the planet in the same way.
So, Michael Mann, again, the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University, and in 2007 he shared the Nobel Peace Prize with others on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and his latest book is The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. So, what would you like the president to say? What do you think would be the best way that he can get the American people engaged in this issue? It's so such a profound threat to human civilization and the planet itself. It requires something like a Manhattan Project or a man on the moon speech that Jack Kennedy made.
Absolutely.
I'm not sure that he's going to rise to that occasion. But if Rubio is going to deny the existence of climate change in the rebuttal, it seems to me incumbent upon the president to really take these people on, because they are so irresponsible, and it's so clear that, you know, a lot of it's to do with our press that has equal and opposite arguments, sure, no matter how bogus they are. So we have this ludicrous situation where creationism is equated with evolution.
Sure. It's almost as if, you know, every time, the analogy would be that every time NASA makes a new discovery in space exploration, they get a member of the Flat Earth Society to present the opposite view. There's, you know, this phenomenon you refer to that I like to call the false objectivity of balance. Simply providing balance is not objective. Accuracy is objective. And you don't put, you know, somebody who is, you know, a mouthpiece for special interests spouting anti-scientific propaganda up on a pedestal, up on the stage with, you know, credible scientists. The National Academy of Sciences is on record. All of the major science societies in the U.S. that involve any area of science relevant to climate change, all of these organizations are on record as affirming that climate change is real, that we are responsible for it, and that there are real risks that are in store if we don't do something about it. So I think Obama does have to make a bold statement about the issue. He said he wants to have a national conversation about the threat posed by climate change. And a good way to begin that conversation would be to make a bold affirmative statement in his State of the Union address about the importance of addressing this problem head on. Now, he may not have the votes right now in Congress to pass legislation in the next 2 years, but that shouldn't stop him from making the case. And that shouldn't stop him from putting in place a strategy and a support structure for moving forward when we do have more favorable circumstances as far as our politics are concerned. Maybe 2 years from now, we'll be in a different position with regard to the makeup of Congress, and we might be able to get meaningful legislation passed. So in the meantime, it makes sense to do the work necessary so that we can move forward as soon as there is an opportunity on passing meaningful legislation to deal with the emission of carbon into the atmosphere, that is, warming the planet, changing our climate, and already having hugely detrimental impacts on our economy and society more generally.
Well, it seems to me, Michael Mann, that we could follow the example of Australia, which is even more impacted by climate change than the United States is. The whole center of the country has had this big pall of baking hot air over the middle, and every time it moved in one direction, it would create bushfires. And then they've had record floods along the Pacific North Coast, and they are an economy very heavily dependent upon the export of coal and uranium, yep, and iron ore, and mining lobbies huge, but nevertheless, they are able to pass a carbon tax. We have a problem here with the coal lobby, because coal is the worst culprit of all in global warming. Right. So what do you think about that?
Well, you know, Australia is an interesting situation because it was literally going up in flames, during their summer, you know, a month ago. Unprecedented heat and drought and wildfire. And the only thing that was thicker than the smoke from those wildfires was the irony that Rupert Murdoch was using his media empire in Australia as all of this was transpiring to continue to deny the science of climate change. And as long as we have this sort of poisoning of the well, this attempt to derail any meaningful discourse about climate change by vested interests like Rupert Murdoch and News Corp and in the U.S., the Koch brothers as well, it is difficult to move forward on this problem when hundreds of millions of dollars are being spent by vested interests to poison the public conversation. We need to get past that. As you note, in Australia, even in that unfavorable environment where, you know, Rupert Murdoch controls much of the media, They have been able to make progress, and we ought to be able to do so here as well. Yes, there are going to be well-funded campaigns to discredit any effort that the president makes to deal with climate change. He's got to recognize that, and he's got to fight back and use the bully pulpit, use the resources that he brings as president of the United States to help move us forward on this issue.
Well, Michael Mann, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Mann, who's the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. He's a co-founder and contributor to the award-winning science website realclimate.org. And in 2007, he shared the Nobel Peace Prize with others on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. His books include Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming, and The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. And we're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back discussing whether the president has spread himself too thin and what advice the Democrats will take from Bill Clinton's recent pep talk.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short head.
Somebody's acting like a child. Somebody's acting like a child. Somebody's acting like a child.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ed Kilgore, who's a principal writer for the Washington Monthly's Political Animal blog. He is also the managing editor of The Democratic Strategist, an online forum, and a senior fellow at the Progressive Policy Institute. He was formerly vice president for policy at the Democratic Leadership Council, communications director for U.S. Senator Sam Nunn, and a federal state relations staffer for three governors of Georgia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ed Kilgore.
Great to be here, Ian.
And on Friday, the former president, Bill Clinton, gave a pep rally to House Democrats at their annual retreat. And of course, on Tuesday, the president gives a State of the Union address. We just got through talking about climate change with this latest superstorm to hit the Northeast. So assuming the president talks about climate change and steps up to the plate on that massive challenge. And then he's got the challenge of immigration. And then gun control was foisted on him by the massacre in Connecticut. Do you think that the president is spreading himself too thin?
Well, I don't know that he has a whole lot of choice. Obviously, getting through this last election liberated him a bit on climate change. The weather events have probably moved a number of people from being climate change skeptics to being climate change believers. You're right. The gun control issue was foisted on him. He's going to have to talk about continuing concerns about the economy. He's got a long-range agenda he's been promoting now for several years that he'll have to talk about. And then there's an impending collision with congressional Republicans over the kind of idiotic pre-planned appropriation sequester and a possible government shutdown over continuing resolution running out. So, you know, we occasionally talk about somebody having to play three-dimensional chess. This is more like five.
And in terms of the sequester and this idea that the United States government is continually held hostage to repetitive manufactured crises, do you think there's a way that he can get the message out there? I mean, the pattern is pretty clear. This is no way to run a railroad, let alone a superpower.
Right. Even before the elections, but certainly since then, public opinion surveys have consistently shown that while nobody's terribly popular at the moment, congressional Republicans are getting the brunt of the blame. I think if we have the sequester go through, which seems likely at the moment, and you have an immediate dampening effect on the economy, and then the drama of a government shutdown, I don't think the president's going to have to do a whole lot to ensure the Republicans get the blame. But, you know, these are real-life problems with a real-life impact on the economy, and ultimately the president's going to have to take responsibility for that, too. As to how he does all the things he needs to do in this speech properly frames this upcoming collision, I mean, even if he did a hour-and-a-half-long Bill Clinton stemwinder, it would be tough.
So what is the problem, then, with the Republicans, Ed Kilgore? Is it that you simply can't get through to the House members and you can't shame them because of the gerrymandering? They're in these safe districts and they're only concerned about somebody further to the right of them running against them in the primary. So they don't really care about the national discourse, or it looks as if they don't even care about the economy of the United States.
Well, you know, there are a lot of different things going on simultaneously. Part of it is that, yes, they are somewhat insulated by all sorts of structural factors, not just the gerrymander, but the, you know, the fact that small states have disproportionate power in the Senate, the residual power to obstruct in the Senate by the filibuster, and the fact that they're coming into a midterm election with an older, whiter electorate. All these things, you know, give Republicans hope that they can continue on their current path and recover. I think you also have to credit the strong possibility that a lot of them believe the stuff they're saying. I'm increasingly convinced that the ultimate source of gridlock in Washington is that the two parties have diametrically opposed philosophies of government, and particularly diametrically opposed ideas of what to do immediately about the economy. Even if you can could come up with a compromise, it might be the kind of compromise that cancels itself out. We may be at this point in American history where one side or the other needs to prevail to get anything done.
Again, I'm speaking with Ed Kilgore, the principal writer for the Washington Monthly's Political Animal blog. He's also the managing editor of the Democratic Strategist, an online forum, and a senior fellow at the Progressive Policy Institute. He was formerly vice president for policy at the Democratic Leadership Council and communications director for United States Senator Sam Nunn. So, to my mind, Ed, you're being a tiny bit kind, but to the Republicans, in the sense that, you know, we just talked about climate change prior to your coming on, and Marco Rubio doesn't even believe it exists, and he's going to give the rebuttal speech. And,
yeah,
and that seems to me to be really irresponsible, and that in many ways the Republicans are becoming a party that don't believe in facts and data.
Right.
So I'm just not sure where the ideology ends and the ignorance begins.
Well, that's always a good question. I'm glad you mentioned Rubio giving the rebuttal, because this is a classic example of how far they've moved just over the last few years. Marco Rubio is a guy who's has extremist positions on a lot of things, including climate change. He was a big supporter of the so-called cut, cap, and balance approach to the budget, which A, is politically impossible, and B, would be an economic catastrophe for the country. And you know, yet somehow or other, he is the new shining face of a new practical Republican Party, primarily because of his involvement in the one issue where Republicans are actually changing their positions, or thinking about it at least, immigration reform. But, you know, 2 years ago, Marco Rubio was considered the face of the new ascended extremism in the Republican Party. His mentor is Jim DeMint, the former South Carolina senator who now runs the Heritage Foundation. So I think one of the stories in politics right now that's really gotten me upset is this idea that the Republican Party is somehow going through a moderating phase and will come out of it not only more popular, but more reasonable. I see no evidence of that whatsoever, except on the immigration issue.
But you were saying earlier, Ed Kilgore, that they'll do well in the midterms, that they're becoming an increasingly white party, and the white vote will come out in 2014?
Well, these are all relative terms. I mean, they may not do well, but they'll do better than they would have. Yeah, one of the little understood phenomena in contemporary politics is that there are two different electorates. There have been for decades a smaller, whiter, and older midterm electorate and a larger and more diverse presidential electorate. What's different right now is that these two electorates have become disproportionately aligned with the two parties. So all other things being equal, Republicans for the time being are going to do better in midterm electorates, elections. They know that. Add in the advantage they're getting from gerrymandering in House races, more efficient vote distribution, and the fact that historically second-term, midterm elections usually cut pretty strongly against the party that controls the White House. These are all factors that will help Republicans get through 2014, and they know it. So this sort of undercuts the incentives they have to be reasonable, to help govern the country, to do anything other than hang tight and hope that conditions improve to their advantage.
Well, Ed Kilgour, I remember speaking to somebody that worked closely with Ronald Reagan in the White House, and when they had their re-election victory and was sort of meeting back in the White House to figure out what they were doing in their second term, they asked Reagan what he wants to do in the second term, and he more or less said, I want to do everything. And they all rolled their eyes, realizing that that's not the way it works, that you really have to pick your fights and pick your priorities in your second term because the clock is ticking on when you become a lame duck. And it seems to me that the President Obama is in that situation, in a sense, particularly with this State of the Union coming up, where he's apparently was planning and will talk about jobs, jobs, and jobs. But then he's probably going to talk about climate change. He has to talk about gun control. And I guess he's going to talk about immigration because that's one of the few things that the Republicans are prepared to compromise on. So is he spreading himself too thin?
Well, what you would hope as a possibility is that he's able to put together a speech that pulls together most, if not all, of those issues into one master narrative of how the country can regain its forward momentum after the calamities that he inherited when he was elected president in 2008. There's an economic dimension to the immigration issue. There's clearly an economic dimension to all the fiscal issues that we're battling about. I mean, you know, you remember back in 2009, a lot of people in both parties criticized him for pursuing health care reform instead of focusing strictly on jobs. I didn't fault him for that, but I did fault him a little bit for not making the economic case for health care reform. And I think you could make an economic case right now, not only for avoiding the kind of austerity policies that congressional Republicans support, but also for efforts by Republicans around the country to subvert health care reform. On occasion, Barack Obama has risen to the occasion and given really remarkable speeches. He needs one on Tuesday that can tie together these disparate issues into a strong case for public trust in his ability to advance his own agenda to help the economy and move the country forward. I don't know if he can do it, but it would be nice.
Well, Ed Kilgour, President Clinton spoke on Friday to a retreat in Virginia for the House Democrats. He brought up the fact that the Democrats should own health care, that they shouldn't run away from it, they should own it. So what do you think about Bill Clinton's advice? It seemed to get a lot of attention in the press. He tutored them on what they should do about guns, immigration, and health care.
Well, I mean, if you look at what most Democrats and apparently the president basically believe, the key to the long-term vibrancy of the economy and to the long-range fiscal challenge is doing something about health care costs, particularly in a way that doesn't deny individuals the opportunity to have some sort of health care security in their own lives. I think he needs to begin making that case very, very strongly, and Democrats around the country do too. Health care reform is not a distraction from economic or fiscal problems. It's essential to it. And at the moment, you have a minimum of 9 Republican governors in some very key states doing everything possible to obstruct the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. This will not only deny millions of people health insurance, it will also frustrate efforts to get a handle on health care costs. So all these things do fit together. Everybody isn't Bill Clinton, who was unusually good at pulling together a lot of different issues into one strong narrative. But I agree, that's what Democrats need to do, and it's what the president needs to do on Tuesday.
And one of the things that Clinton told the House Democrats at their retreat was he talked about the austerity trap and how Paul Krugman has been right when he keeps talking about these things. Everybody that's tried austerity in a time of no growth has wound up cutting revenues even more than they cut spending, because they just get into the downward spiral and drag the economy back into recession. That's quoting Bill Clinton. Do you think President Obama can make a stand at the State of the Union? He's got a good bully pulpit there, a lot of people watching, and put the Republicans on notice that if they go ahead and push this sequester and take all that money out of the economy, they are going to create a new recession. And all of the recovery since the 2008 crash will be out the window. And it seems cruel and unusual punishment to the American people.
Well, yes, I think he does need to make that case, and I think he can. I think he needs to constantly draw attention to the fact that even those Republicans that want to avoid the sequester simply want to substitute even larger short-term domestic spending cuts for what would happen with the sequester, so it'd make it even worse. So, absolutely, part of the progressive critique of the president off and on over the last 2 or 3 years has been that he's made too many concessions on spending reductions. Actually, his position all along has been that we need two things simultaneously. We need short-term fiscal stimulus to keep the economy growing and long-term steps to bring the federal budget into alignment that do not affect the current economy. Somehow or other, that message has not gotten through very clearly to the public, and I think, again, Tuesday is the perfect opportunity to do so.
So on your other point, Ed Kilgore, that the Republicans are hanging on there, and then they're not so worried that even though they're polling at 8% of approval ratings, and frankly, I wonder who that 8% are, but that they feel confident that they'll do well in the midterms in 2014, because that's just the way the historical model operates.
Well, I think there are two things going on here that you do have to keep in mind. You know, one, the current trajectory of the Republican Party is part of a half-century-long march of the conservative movement to take over the Republican Party. They finally succeeded, and they're not going to give up very easily just because of one or two or even three bad election cycles. The second thing to keep in mind is that they're playing a long game. The opportunity to do what they really want to do, which is to reverse and roll back the whole New Deal Great Society legacy, they can take a number of bites at that very big apple, and it only takes winning once. So, I don't think they're that focused on a lot of them, focused on the short-term electoral prospects of the Republican Party. It won't affect most of them. They don't have to control the White House or Congress to have significant power to obstruct, as we keep seeing. So, I'm not so sure that they're deluded in that belief that they can play an obstructing role from a minority position. But I do think we need to recognize that Republicans are not simply motivated by their reading of election polls for 2014 or 2016, and that makes them very dangerous.
Well, Clinton acknowledged that in his speech on Friday to the House Republicans at their retreat, that the Republicans are gearing up for a massive effort in 2014 like they did in 2010 when they caught the Democrats by surprise. Now, presumably, they won't catch them by surprise in 2014. But would that mean that, is there a way to break that cycle? Because one of the statistics that was so extraordinary was in 2008, about 140 million Americans voted for Obama and the Democrats in a landslide. In 2010, about half of that, about 75 million voted. So that deficit, it's almost half of it. How do you get that other half out in a midterm?
Well, I think you have to be realistic. Again, this disparity between midterm and presidential turnout is nothing new. It's been this way for decades. You can't simply wish it away. A lot of the people who are now an important part of the Obama building on some of the technologies that worked so well in 2012, and, you know, and there are opportunities to peel away a portion of the Republican coalition. You know, right now, over 65 white voters, white seniors, are an increasingly important part of the Republican coalition. As recently as 2006, Democrats broke even in that vote. So I think Democrats have to be realistic about their what they can do in a midterm election. But they could certainly actually make gains in 2014, and then maybe that would produce a sense of realism in the Republican Party, and to use the president's words, break the fever. You could only hope so.
Well, Ed Kilgour, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Always a pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Ed Kilgour, who's the principal writer for the Washington Monthly's Political Animal blog. He's also the managing editor of The Democratic Strategist, an online forum, and a senior fellow at the Progressive Policy Institute. He was formerly vice president for policy at the Democratic Leadership Council, communications director for United States Senator Sam Nunn, and a federal state relations staffer for three governors of Georgia. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with an author and journalist who has covered the LAPD more than anybody, and of course the LAPD is under siege at the moment.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Joe Dominic, who is an award-winning investigative journalist, author, and professor at the USC Annenberg Institute for Justice and Journalism. He's also the associate director of the Center on Media, Crime, and Justice at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice and the West Coast Bureau Chief of the Crime Report. His latest book is Cruel Justice, Three Strikes in the Politics of Crime in America's Golden State. His previous book is To Protect and Serve, The LAPD Century of War in the City of Dreams, which won the 1995 Edgar Allan Poe Award for Best Nonfiction Book. And he's currently working on a new book, Road to Reckoning, The Collapse and Reformation of the LAPD. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joe Dominic.
Thank you very much, Ian. It's a pleasure to be on America's best radio show.
Well, thank you, Joe. It seems, though, at this moment that not only are the LAPD and its police force and indeed its families being stalked by a suspect, but they're also being haunted by their brutal past, are they not?
Well, that's exactly the story, as this guy's story has to do with the LAPD, where it appears, I haven't done independent reporting on this, Ian, but it very much appears as if the LAPD actually did everything right with this guy that's on the run. You know, I think the fact that they fired him, he was a probationary officer, he was clearly mentally unstable at the time, was they did exactly the right thing. But in terms of their past, it's almost like O.J. all over again, Ian, where O.J. Simpson became a hero in Black America, and Black America cheered the acquittal of an obviously guilty man because it was fighting against it. They looked on it as fighting against a police force that had made their life a horror show for the last 40 years, and this was a triumph. O.J. was a triumph over that, and I think that they're paying the same price for that now with this questioning of whether this clearly mentally unstable guy's accusations have validity. And there's a segment of the African American population that is inclined to believe that they do have validity, even though I believe, in fact, they don't.
So, Joe Dominic, this fugitive officer, Christopher Dorner, who's suspected of killing three people, and he put out this strange manifesto on his Facebook page that also has a long list of people that he approves of, movies that he approves of, journalists and television personalities that he approves of, including Pat Harvey of the CBS local television anchor here, who did a long interview with the now head of the LAPD, Charlie Beck, who seemed to go out of his way to try and offer an olive branch, if you will, to this fugitive, saying that they would reopen and re-examine his case, even though it's been examined on a number of occasions. What do you know about the actual firing of Dorner in 2008? Apparently because he lied over a complaint against his field training officer, saying she had kicked a suspect, a schizophrenic man, with severe dementia during an arrest. What's the details here, and what's at the heart of this beef that he has that's caused him to threaten, kill police and threaten their families?
Well, clearly there's, I don't want to play amateur or shrink here, but clearly the guy is filled with incredible rancor, and also has this really strong persecution complex, because as the LA Times has been reporting, one of the people that he's, I don't know, directly threatened, but certainly holds a grudge against is his junior high school principal for allegedly, doing some minor thing to him. So we know that he also shot himself in the hand while he was in the police academy. And was somebody who was constantly getting into beefs with other officers. There's no indication that his training partner in San Pedro was somebody who was has any record of doing something like kicking a suspect. And I think that this was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back. This was a probationary officer. They wanted to get rid of him because he appeared to be, unstable. They didn't even want him on the force, so they fired him. Normally, that might not have been a fireable offense, but I think the totality of his behavior was what caused the firing.
Well, it seems as though, Joe Dominic, compounding that is the fact that the U.S. Navy, he was a reserve lieutenant, they kicked him out too. That just happened recently, and he was down in San Diego. So it seems like this man's having an identity crisis.
Right, and I don't think, I don't think the LAPD has done anything wrong in this case. Looks like they've done what's right. But one of the things that is concerning is the shooting of the two women who were delivering newspapers, and then yesterday the Torrance, and that was by the LAPD. Yesterday the Torrance police deliberately smashing into a truck that looked like the truck that this suspect this officer had been driving, and just no regard to the fact that using smart tactics and not endangering the public. This is now twice in this manhunt that innocent people have been endangered by the police.
Well, there's certainly no excuse. Yeah, There's certainly no excuse for that, Joe Dominic. Again, award-winning investigative journalist, author, and professor at USC's Annenberg Institute for Justice and Journalism. He is the author of two books on the LAPD, Cruel Justice, To Protect and Serve, the LAPD Century of War in the City of Dreams. And his forthcoming book is Road to Reckoning, the Collapse and Reformation of the LAPD. In his interview with Pat Harvey of CBS, local CBS TV here, Charlie Beck did mention that there are 50 LAPD families under protection now with protection details. And of course, the two women that were shot delivering the LA Times were apparently coming close to one of those locations when they were shot by dozens of rounds. It's a miracle that they both survived with very light wounds, given the dozens of shots were fired. It was, needless to say, the wrong truck, the wrong color, the wrong make. I think that tells you, though, doesn't it, how freaked out the police are?
It tells me how freaked out the police are, but it's no excuse. They're not supposed to be freaked out. They're supposed to be highly paid professionals who shouldn't be making these kinds of mistakes. This was, you know, this was not that they were in any way thought that they were in danger. You know, I mean, there was no indication of any danger coming from this truck or from these women. And to open up like that is really poor performance in a life-threatening situation. It's very bad tactics, and they need to be criticized for that. And I really don't want... This wasn't an incident where a cop turns a corner and he spies somebody there and he thinks that the guy is reaching for a weapon and he accidentally shoots him. This is a very bad situation. I understand that things happen very quickly, but there's no excuse for those kind of tactics.
So in terms of this strange manifesto that Christopher Dorner posted on his Facebook page, where he goes into accuses the LAPD of a history of racism, cover-ups, and corruption, and claims that the things are worse now than they were in the Rodney King's days, and the LAPD officers celebrate dead bodies on crime scenes as a bonus to their paycheck. This is obviously not going to be helpful here in a community that is trying to get over some of the serial abuses of African Americans going back to Rodney King, and you still have shootings. One of the things, though, that I find extraordinary about this guy's claim, which sort of undermines his idea that that he's a credible source on the question of racism, is that he also, in his manifesto, all the people that he likes and the movies he likes and comedians like Larry David, I mean, it's so bizarre, the panoply of people. He goes on to say that he loves Bill Handel, you're effing awesome. For years, I've enjoyed your show. And John and Ken from KFI, never mute your facts and personal opinions. You're one of the few media personalities who speak the truth, even when the truth is not popular. I'll miss listening. I mean, he's obviously talking about this in the past tense. I will miss listening to your discussions. Well, those guys are pretty racist, aren't they, John and Ken? This guy's not exactly tracking with his facts, is he?
No, I mean both of them are both on both of those shows, John and Ken and Bill Handel. They are, I mean, their racism, and I don't think that that's an inaccurate description, is directed at undocumented immigrants in Los Angeles, you know, who they have nothing but contempt for. And don't hide it, which, you know, it's kind of an amazing thing that this is Los Angeles, you know, as opposed to someplace else. Yeah, so he's clearly a deeply disturbed guy. But you know, you mentioned all of these accusations that he's making. You know, that was there was truth to that in 1999. But there's not truth to that. Certainly, it hasn't gotten worse. It's gotten enormously better. In 1999, when we had the Rampart scandal, as you recall, Ian, and we had Ray Perez doing all of these things, and the you know, the entire crash unit at Rampart Crash and probably in other crash units throughout the city, well, which were never examined. You had exactly those kinds of things going on. But this is, I can tell you, this is not going on. Certainly not going on with the concurrence of anybody in any high rank within the department. They're working to do exactly the opposite, and I think fairly successfully. One of the reasons you haven't heard big outcry from people that have some credibility and weight in the African American community is because they know what's going on. And we've had two African American presidents of the police commission. We've had two African American chiefs. So sure, I mean, racism and classism and the whole mission of urban police departments to contain minority people, makes some of this inevitable. But I think that the LAPD has gone a long way in trying to alleviate it.
Well, I think what you're saying here, Joe Dominic, is the LAPD's gone a long way from the days of Darrell Gates, who was a reactionary and probably a racist. And since then, I mean, the last two, the current one, Charlie Beck, and the previous head, Bratton, were of this new kind of highly educated. I mean, I saw the press. I mean, the interview that he did with Pat Harvey Beck, and he's clearly a very smart guy.
He's extremely smart. I think what he just did in terms of reopening, and maybe this is some kind of backhanded message to this guy that is bizarre enough that maybe the guy will believe it. But I really think that it's that he understands that when you don't have anything to hide, you don't have anything to hide. So why not, why not be open? Why not do this and put this to rest? I think it's part of his community policing and strategy and his community relations strategy, which has been very successful, especially in his outreach to the African American community and places like Jordan Downs and the housing projects down in Watts.
So I take it this is what your new book, The Road to Reckoning: The Collapse and Reformation of the LAPD, is about. To some extent, yeah.
Yeah, well, no, that's exactly right. The book starts with the 92 riots, goes through the disaster of 5 years of Willie Williams as chief, the even bigger disaster of 5 years of Bernard Parks as chief, and then the start on the road to reformation.
So I don't know. I mean, we're trying to watch the wires in case something's happening here. But as far as I know, nobody knows where this guy is. They think he's up in the mountains somewhere. But they're also, I think, quite concerned that he's fairly clever and determined to wreak havoc. And as Beck mentioned in his interview, 50 police families are being protected at the moment. So I take it this guy's going to be go down in flames, right? We only got a few seconds left to him. Sorry.
Right. He probably will go down in flames. And who knows if he's not already taken his life? I mean, he's in a very desperate situation. Right. If he's up in the mountains, he could be very likely freezing to death. Sure. Who knows right now? It's hard to speculate.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Joe Dominic.
Great to talk. Great to talk to you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Joe Dominic, who's an award-winning investigative journalist, author, and professor at the USC's Annenberg Institute for Justice and Journalism. He's also the associate director of the Center for Media, Crime, and Justice at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice and the West Coast Bureau Chief of the Crime Report. His latest book is Cruel Justice, Three Strikes and the Politics of Crime in America's Golden State. And his previous book, To Protect and Serve, the LAPD's Century of War in the City of Dreams, won the 1995 Edgar Allan Poe Award for Best Nonfiction Book. And he's currently working on a new book, Road to Reckoning, The Collapse and Reformation of the LAPD. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.